into agenda item four. We are running behind time, but we're looking forward to this. So with that, Jim, I'll turn it over to you.
Chair Smith, members of the commission, Director Unsworth, I'm Jim Scott, and I am very excited today to be able to talk with you about steelhead. It seems like it's been a long time coming. We've had a few salmon issues on the table for a few years now, so it's nice to get back and talk about steelhead. We're going to start off the part one of really a three-part presentation this morning with an overview of the statewide plan and some initiatives to implement it. I have with me a very illustrious panel that I'd like to have introduce themselves, starting to my left.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the commission. For the record, my name is Jeff Davis. I'm your assistant director with responsibility of the Habitat Program.
Good morning, commission. I'm Annette Hoffman. I'm the fish program manager in Region 4.
Good morning. I'm Steve Teasfeld, the Region 6 Fish Program Manager. Am I going to a timeout, Commissioner Carpenter?
No. No? Okay. Nice to see you, Steve. Everyone else is left.
Okay, we have a pretty simple outline. We're going to start off with the what we call the Steelhead Science Paper, which was the genesis for the statewide steelhead management plan. We're then going to have an overview of the plan itself, look at some of our priority implementation tasks, and then at the end, take stock of what we intended to accomplish and how successful we have been in moving forward with our steelhead management. Just to give you a little bit of a feel for our steelhead landscape in the state, as you know, for ESA listing purposes, steelhead are broken into large groups of population called distinct population segments, or DPS. In Washington, we have seven of those spread from the Upper Columbia, the Middle Columbia, Snake, Lower Columbia, Puget Sound, Olympic Peninsula, and Southwest Washington. Colors are a little hard to see there on the screen, but one important message is that five of those seven are listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The only two that aren't listed are the Olympic Peninsula and the Southwest Washington. And in fact, at the initial listing, the Upper Columbia was endangered status for a period, I think, of 3 years. So that was the landscape that we initiated when we initiated the Steelhead Science Paper. Our intent was to take a critical look at the scientific underpinnings of our steelhead management. The science paper was developed over a period of 4 years. It went through multiple external reviews and came up with 50 findings and recommendations. Quite a hefty document. I carry it around with me, as my staff members will tell you, for frequent reference. And it, again, served as the foundation for the development of the statewide steelhead management plan. And when, as we moved towards completion of that science paper, it was evident to us that we needed a new management paradigm for steelhead. And I've contrasted on this slide on the left the old management approach, on the right what we called 21st century management. I'm not going to go through all of those, recognizing we're a bit behind schedule. I do want to touch on two or three of them, though. First one, abundance and productivity. Historically, on our steelhead management, we just focused on the number of adult returns. 21st century management, particularly for steelhead, we recognize the importance of diversity. Steelhead are very diverse in their genetic characteristics and life history characteristics. We recognize we needed to pay more attention to that. Second one, the single sector management. Historically, we looked at each sector, habitat, hatcheries, harvest, individually, did not attempt to integrate those, and really, I would say, focused on the harvest management sector. And again, the thought was, that's not an effective way to approach a management. We need to integrate those, and most importantly, we need to pay more attention to habitat. And then the third one there I want to highlight was our old concept of hatcheries as isolated fish factories. During the development of the science paper, we had a lot of assistance from the Hatchery Scientific Review Group, and we learned that the proper way, the valuable way to think about hatcheries as part of the ecosystem in which they reside, and that they need to have specific goals and objectives to be effectively used. So we...
Can I even back up one?
Yep.
And I'm going to throw my ignorance, but what is S-H-A-N? Or S...
Ah!
S-H-A-N.
Yep, so the fourth bullet there, MSH, that's maximum sustainable harvest. And the historical paradigm, I would say, in much of fisheries management was that we would allow the number of spawners back to spawning areas to maximize a sustainable harvest in the subsequent generation. Now, as we've learned more, and particularly for steelhead, we came to recognize that we might need a spawner, we might need more spawners than that to have the types of steelhead populations that we want. And so an evolution in our thinking, moving away from MSH to potentially recognize that we may need more spawners to achieve our diversity, spatial structure, and fishery objectives. Okay, so that was the kind of thought process we had moving into the development of the statewide plan. It was an extensive stakeholder process. We did a full environmental impact statement in the years from 2006 to 2008. And the Fish and Wildlife Commission in 2008 adopted 8 policy statements from the plan. And those included policy statements for artificial production, natural production, habitat protection and restoration, fishery management, and monitoring, evaluation, and adaptive management. And the statewide plan is comprehensive, 42 pages, 57 strategies, 95 actions. And again, many of you know, carry around my dog-eared copy at all times for reference. It's incredibly valuable from my perspective and my day-to-day thinking about how to approach steelhead management. So to characterize it at a high level, I'd say it's very expansive. I'd say it was a very bold plan. I'd say it was very ambitious, now looking back. And a fair question, I think, is how have we done in implementing it? So the approach I'm going to try and take here in the next 20, 25 minutes, can't go through all of the 95 actions that are in the plan and give you a real understanding of where we've been successful or where we haven't been successful. What we're going to do is focus on those that were the highest priority from our perspective. And what I'm going to try and do in each of them is have a logic chain where we start with the finding from the science paper, we go to the policy statement in the plan, and then drop down to the specific strategies or actions that the plan directed us to undertake. So first up, we're going to start with the artificial production component of the plan. And the situation we found in Western Washington at that time was nearly all of our hatchery programs were from two brood stocks. One we call the Chambers Creek winter brood stock, and the second one from what we call the Skamania River summer brood stock. And those types of fish were used in over 80% of our hatchery programs in Western Washington. It's raised a couple concerns. These were what we call highly domesticated fish. That means they didn't perform well in the wild. They do great in a hatchery, not so well in the wild. And by using them across the entire landscape of Washington, Western Washington, we posed a real potential risk to reduce the diversity of our steelhead stocks, our wild steelhead stocks. So the finding in the science paper was that the Chambers Creek winter and Skamania River summer steelhead programs pose a high potential genetic risk. The policy statement then and the statewide plan that addressed that basically said if we have our artificial production programs for harvest, like these two are, well, they better provide harvest benefits, number one, and they better be implemented in a way that's consistent with watershed-specific goals for diversity, spatial structure, productivity, and abundance. So again, just to focus on one strategy within the plan, focused on these, what we call the Skamania and the Chambers Creek fish. The strategy that was identified in the plan, it says, for programs affecting wild stocks of importance for conservation and long-term recovery, these segregated harvest programs need to have a gene flow of less than 2% to the wild stocks. So if you think about our rivers and fish returning from generation to generation, if you go from one generation to the next and are looking at the wild fish, you don't want more than 2% of the genetic characteristics of that stock, the wild stock, to be coming from hatchery fish in the previous generation. So less than 2% gene flow rate. Pretty strict standard. So how have we done? We've made substantial program modifications. Our have a three-pronged strategy. First, we assess the programs for compliance with that 2% standard, and if necessary, redesign them to meet the standard. We then put in place a monitoring program to ensure that the modifications to the program result in the gene flow that we had projected. And finally, as a fail-safe mechanism, we're establishing wild steelhead gene banks throughout the state. Just to give you a bit of an example of how this has changed our production, Puget Sound, there's been more than a 50% reduction in the number of fish released and a more than 65% reduction in the number of release locations. We've done some very original, cutting-edge analysis of gene flow. I believe Dr. Warheit may be in our audience here, and without giving him too big a head, want to say that I'm not aware of research or monitoring like we've done has been done anywhere else. Just an incredible work, incredible advancement. And the graphic here, I'm not going to go through it in detail with you, but basically, across the bottom, you see different populations of steelhead and Puget Sound, winter steelhead, actually winter and summer. The y-axis is the estimated gene flow rate, and that's estimated from empirical data collections, samples of fish on the spawning grounds or juveniles. The black dots are the estimated gene flow from an early winter steelhead program to each of those populations. And the red line is that 2% gene flow standard. So the kind of the two key messages here are, one, you can see that some of our past programs, the black dots, had gene flow rates greater than 2%, some cases substantially greater. And most importantly, though, looking forward, the red dots show the projected gene flow with our program modifications, and all of those are now below that 2% gene flow standard. A substantial change in our hatchery programs in Puget Sound. Of course, the question then is, will the program changes result in the changes that we have projected? That's why we're setting up monitoring programs and adaptively managing the hatcheries. And we're going to come back to this in a slide later in this presentation. We've focused our efforts mostly on Puget Sound and the Lower Columbia up till this time because of the ESA listings. We've taken a first cut at the Washington coastal programs, but we'll be moving to a more intensive look at those programs here in the next couple of years. Okay, so we're going to move to the next policy area, natural production. And the science paper finding here was that if we're going to have steelhead in Washington, we've got to have steelhead populations, and they got to be locally adapted and diverse. But as we looked at what we were working with, we noted that already there's been a substantial loss of steelhead populations in many regions, a range of 0 to 55% loss of populations within these distinct population segments. So the policy statement that the steelhead management plan put forward and was adopted by the commission, steelhead management shall place the highest priority on the protection of wild stocks to maintain and restore these stocks to healthy levels. So, well, how do we do that? We're going to just touch on two of the strategies that were identified in the plan. The first one is we set up a analysis and reporting mechanism to give us an alert if we were at danger of losing another steelhead population. And we call that our at-risk reporting procedure. And we'll have a full presentation on that immediately following. Again, the idea there is at five-year intervals, we'd analyze populations across the state, identify any that were at risk, and identify the management actions to address that. The other key strategy that was identified in the plan was to create this network of wild steelhead gene banks. And basically, the idea there is where you have a you're going to identify some situations, some watersheds where you have wild steelhead, and in those populations, you're not going to have any releases of hatchery fish at all. Again, this idea of a fail-safe mechanism to protect the diversity of wild steelhead statewide. Yes, sir.
Statewide, you're talking.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, there again, I'm just trying to figure out how this is going to be applicable to my part of the world because our steelhead fishing is a huge deal. And there again, wild, we've planted fish in that part of the world forever.
Yep.
But the ones we have now are very adaptable, and we get some fantastic runs. And I just... when you start saying no hatchery releases, I get really concerned really quickly.
Yeah, so we're gonna have a map here pretty quick that'll show your particular area and the actions that we actually have taken there already. So again, the idea here is not that every population will have no hatchery releases; that we will select some throughout the state where we will not have hatchery releases, and The plan directs us to establish one wild steelhead gene bank for each major population group. So there's another bit of jargon for you. Just kind of think about the hierarchy. We have the distinct population segments. That's that big group. For example, Puget Sound is one distinct population segment. Then you have the major population groups below that in Puget Sound. So there's a North Puget Sound. There's a South Puget Sound. And then there's a combination Hood Canal, Strait of Juan de Fuca. So three major population groups within Puget Sound. And the plan directs us to establish one wild steelhead gene bank in each major population group. So, question, what have we done? It turns out, up till now, we've established at least one wild steelhead gene bank in seven major population groups throughout the state. And those comprise 12 individual populations. And we have a map here to show how those are distributed across the state. And going first to the Snake River area, For Snake River, we've established two wild steelhead gene banks, one for the Assotin and one for Joseph Creek, the Lower Grand Ronde Tribs. Those are already in place. Moving to the Upper Columbia, we've established one in the Antietam River. And then in the Mid-Columbia River, we've got four populations within the Yakima Basin. The most recent group was established in the Lower Columbia area about 2 years ago now, I believe it is, for the North Fork Tootle, the East Fork Lewis, and the Wind River. And then the Solduck River was established, it must be 5 years ago now. Many commissioners may remember that public process we went through to establish the Solduck. You'll notice that there's two areas of not much pink on them, Puget Sound and Southwest Washington, and you may be asking, well, what about those? So for Puget Sound, we have a public process currently underway. We've had four public meetings, and we anticipate that we would be establishing the wild steelhead gene banks for Puget Sound here within the next 3 to 6 months. Similarly, we have a public process underway for rivers populations near the mouth of the Columbia River. That's called the Coast Major Population Group. And again, anticipate putting some wild steelhead gene banks in place there within 3 to 6 months. So at that point, we would have at least one wild steelhead gene bank in each of the DPSs across the state. Doesn't mean we're done. We then anticipate moving on to Willapa Bay and Grays Harbor as our next key areas for that public process to identify those wild steelhead gene banks. So I'm going to move to habitat protection and restoration. And as I said near the start of the presentation, I think one of our recognitions was that we needed to have a much better integration of our habitat folks with our fish folks, and that we needed to have an increased emphasis on habitat protection and restoration. It was driven in part by a steelhead science paper finding that degradation of riverine, estuarine, and nearshore habitat has resulted in the loss of an average of 83% of the potential production of the 42 steelhead populations that we assessed. So a large reduction in the production potential of our steelhead rivers. And the policy statement that was included in the statewide plan was, we better protect and restore the quality, quantity, and productivity of those habitats necessary to sustain and restore our steelhead. So I'm very excited that Jeff Davis was able to join with us today and talk with us about the habitat actions that we're putting in place.
Thanks, Jim. So as you all know, the department, the tribes, and our partners do a lot of work in the Habitat Protection and Restoration Forum. You just recently updated our hydraulic project approval rules, so we have direct authority to protect fish and their habitat. As well as we work with our partners to do freshwater and marine nearshore habitat restoration that helps. But we chose to focus on these two, eliminating fish passage barriers and protecting and restoring in-stream flows in this presentation today. Fish passage, I'm sure you're all aware of the federal court injunction regarding culverts. It directed the state to correct fish passage barriers in certain time frames. I believe our deadline was 2016. You'll be hopefully pleasantly surprised to know that we will be done with our culvert injunction requirements by the end of 2015. So you'll see there that we've been at, excuse me, at this for a little while. Since 1999, we've corrected 129 barriers to fish passage on our ground. Next. This one, I'm really excited to share this slide with you. You may or may not know that we have an in-stream flow science section in our science division, and those folks study in-stream flow and the effects that it can have on habitat productivity by species. And they also provide support to the Department of Ecology in making or supporting decisions regarding water rights. So really important work here to protect in-stream flows. And we also provide a great deal of support to local governments or landowners, irrigation districts, on how to achieve their goals and balance those with protecting in-stream flows. This particular slide is happening right now, and I am very happy to say that this is the Kittitas Reclamation District. They're doing phenomenal things on behalf of fish right now. Some of this comes from a long created opportunity in the Yakima Integrated Basin Plan, where, quite frankly, from my observations, we got tired of fighting with each other, and we collectively came forward and figured out a way that we could understand each other's issues, own those, and create solutions. This, as an example, Kittitas Reclamation District is, on a daily basis, purchasing PVC pipe, running water through their irrigation system, and putting that water into Upper Yakima tributary streams to protect fish. And that's an amazing effort. You can see in the bottom left there, that's Menashtash, I believe in June, and you can see what it looks like today. And they continue to increase the flow in these tributary streams to protect the juveniles and prepare for adults moving in. The beautiful thing about this is that the senior water right holders downstream aren't losing out on any of their water rights. We're just simply using different routes to get the water down to them. Next. So, next steps. We're continuing to focus our inventories outside of the culvert and junction on our hatchery diversion structures. So we're identifying where those diversions may preclude fish passage, and working with fish program and our camp program in order to get those corrected while maintaining our water sources. And we also are chairing the Fish Barrier Removal Board, created 2 sessions ago by the legislature, and they are tasked with developing a statewide fish barrier removal strategy. We're very close in having that strategy out. It will focus on priority stream systems and focused on improving coordination and collaboration with the various fish barrier owners. Yes, sir.
Just a quick question. Are you working with the RFEGs on all of this?
Yeah, so RFEGs, we administer funding to that program, and they're part of our fish barrier removal. They're part of our drought response. We also are working with conservation districts, local governments, DOT, tribes. Regional recovery boards are the folks that we've asked to tell us where their priority watershed is that we should focus our initial efforts. The tough task will be this. We're talking about literally thousands of fish barriers across the state. That's blind to ownership. And how do we all come together and get enough financial resources in order to really start to tackle these in the priority areas? On in-stream flow, I think we're doing great things, and I think we continue to do those. Our next step is to continue to focus on the relationships, enhancing those relationships in the coordination, both with irrigation districts, private landowners that need water, and local governments that need municipal water sources. I'm out.
Okay. So, moving to fishery management, another major policy section in the plan. And the science finding there was really pointing out that fishery management is about trade-offs and making sure that we have the tools to effectively analyze those trade-offs and that we have public process in place to allow us to engage the public in understanding where we want to operate along those trade-offs. So, for example, habitat, a trade-off that you may not think about, but if habitat is degraded, probably means there's going to be fewer fish. That's the trade-off that we have. I think that was mentioned by a gentleman earlier this morning, that we benefit from roads, houses. Well, there's probably effect on the numbers of fish that will come back. Second, if we're going to sustain fisheries in the face of habitat degradation, we oftentimes turn to hatchery programs. And if those hatchery programs aren't operated correctly, there can be a loss in the fitness of the natural population. So there can be trade-offs between harvest levels and fitness. And then the third one, there could be trade-offs between harvest levels and population diversity. Turns out that all fish aren't created equal. And if you set your harvest, your allowable harvest on the average population, probably some lower productive components of your population are going to be lost. So those are examples of the types of trade-offs that we face in fishery management. The policy basically says, well, manage fisheries to achieve the diversity, spatial structure, abundance, and productivity that were established for each stock. So we're going to focus in on a couple examples of that. One of them is a strategy identified in the plan to protect juvenile steelhead and resident rainbow trout. Second, we're going to talk about a strategy in the plan that requires us to adaptively manage the fisheries to ensure that they're responsive to current productivity and region-wide goals. And we're going to have two examples there, our North Coast Steelhead Advisory Group process that we have underway currently, and the Skagit Steelhead Fishery Plan that we had at least two folks speak to this morning. In terms of the protection for juvenile steelhead and trout, the conclusion that we came to after reviewing the status of our steelhead was that one size fits all in terms of protection for juvenile fish wasn't going to restore steelhead, that we'd lost too much of our steelhead abundance. We had significant concerns about extirpation. And to us, the conclusion was that perhaps a one-size-fits-all management system for juvenile steelhead may have worked in the past. It wasn't going to work in this age when five of our seven steelhead or DPSs were listed and some individual populations were close to extirpation. So previous standard for statewide typically had a open first Saturday in June, close the end of October, typically open to the use of bait, 8-inch minimum size limit, oftentimes a 2-fish daily limit. And what we came forward to the commission with is what we called our stream strategy, where for every stream, we looked at the status of the steelhead, and we looked at the biology of the steelhead and trout in that system, and tailored specific rules for each stream. We did that over a period of 6 years with you folks, and I appreciated your indulgence over those 6 years. It was a long and arduous process. 2010, you adopted new rules for Puget Sound. 2012, the Washington Coast. And most recently, 2014 for the Columbia River Basin. So a fundamental analysis and reshaping of our approach to protecting juvenile steelhead. So with that, I want to move to the North Coast steelhead process, and Mr. Teasfeld.
Thank you, Jim. North Coast Steelhead Process, we're talking about three major basins, the Quileute, the Hoh, and the Queets, arguably our stronghold of steelhead within the state for wild production, support healthy runs of fish in most of those systems, healthy fisheries in most of the all three of those systems, both state and tribal. The last place in the state where we allow wild retention of steelhead by the sport fishery. As we've made changes to the hatchery production and regulations in other areas, and especially Puget Sound, there's an increasing belief that the effort out on the peninsula has dramatically risen as folks have lost opportunities in other places. There's also been a bit of a decline in certain populations. The Hoh specifically is the one that has me very concerned at the moment. Our public expresses extreme concern about treaty, non-treaty sharing, which often does not end up at a 50-50 division of the harvestable surplus. While these concerns have been expressed, we've just entered into the midst of a sport rules proposal process back in, I believe we started in May. We knew that we were going to get a significant number of proposals regarding steelhead management on the North Coast. One of our concerns was, how could we direct that to a more holistic approach to dealing with steelhead on the North Coast rather than a piecemeal approach, gear by gear, river by river, stretch by stretch, and maybe thinking about it broader context and applying it across the whole North Coast area. In order to facilitate a more holistic approach, we did initiate an advisory group beginning last month. It's a diverse group of 13 very passionate anglers. We have folks that are wild fish advocates. We have guides that are currently making a living on the resource out there. And then we have also just what we'd like to think is just a regular Joe weekend warrior part of the team. An immense amount of talent and knowledge about those systems that we have sitting around the table. We had basically four tasks that we've asked this group to think about, reviewing the current stock assessment and biological information and fishery regulations and information. How many are we catching? How are we catching them? When is it open? Are the populations going up or down? Reviewing the proposals that have already been submitted by the public, and our goal is to have them develop a proposal or two or three for the commission to really get their teeth around and put that back out to the public as here's what we believe is a more holistic approach. Review information about guiding out on the peninsula. Guiding is a hot-button topic out there. Our guides are extremely successful as opposed to many of the just average anglers out there. By themselves, they can have a large impact on the resource. If let's just leave it at that. And we've been tasking this group with thinking about the long-term strategies to try to resolve the issues that we have out there. And then the final piece we've asked them to look at is reviewing our hatchery programs. Our hatchery programs are relatively small and confined to the Quileute system, but there are tribal facilities in the Hoh and the Queet system.
Can you back up for just a second?
Yes, sir.
Concerning guides, do they have to be licensed guides, and are there any numbers of guides that can be on any given stretch?
No, and that's kind of the crux of the concern is that at this point in time, we have an unlimited number of guides available or guides within the state. There's no limit on how many game fish guides can get a license. And as those opportunities for fishing have decreased, especially in Puget Sound, there appear to be an influx of guides coming out to the coast. And so this concern is not only is fishing pressure in general increasing, but the guides are coming over in greater abundance and staying. So one of the strategies might be, what could we do to perhaps limit guides or cap guide licenses, similar to what we do with charter boat licenses? The group is willingly step forward to try to tackle that issue and maybe make some proposals that we would have to carry forward. Obviously, legislation would be required if we decided to go that route, and that would be a long-term strategy for us rather than something for the near term.
Do you think you're going to do it just specifically for that area, or is it going to be a statewide deal if you do it?
We've just broached the topic here recently, and we're.
I mean, what are you looking at? What are you thinking in the back of your mind?
Well, what am I thinking, or what is the advisory group thinking? I would say, based on our discussions that we've had so far, the advisory group is looking at potentially limiting participation on the peninsula only. So, but we've tried to point out the difficulties of this does require legislative help if we're going to go that route, and so that's it's not a problem or an issue that we're going to resolve in the next year or two. We'd have to develop our legislative package to get that, if that's what we believe is a long-term sustainable strategy.
I was just curious because there again, my part of the world, we see a lot of guides that, and we get influxes from coastal guides coming over and doing, and there again, in Washington, Idaho waters, they can probably play both sides of that game. Yeah. But
yeah, as we develop this issue and wrestle with it within the group, it may be that they decide that they want to tackle it on the statewide basis, or that we come back with an idea that we think it needs to be addressed statewide. But it's in its infancy. We're just starting it.
So. Did you have question on that?
Yeah, Steve, are you looking at a permit process, for example? Would that require legislative participation if you just went to a permit structure and only, you know, issued so many permits per season or per day or whatever?
I would have to ask our council for guidance on that. I don't believe so.
Right.
And that might be an alternative. It's clearly on the table already from the group.
Okay.
They're looking at places like the Skeena where there's limited numbers per day and suggesting that that might be an alternative. Yeah.
Sure, the Deschutes River in Oregon has been on a permit basis for years.
Yep.
So there's good examples, Steve, of that.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, I think you're, correct me if I'm wrong, you're talking about limited entry in some sort.
In one way or another, yes. If you either cap licenses or restrict the number of guides per day. I will say the guides are pushing back a little bit. We have a number of them on the group, and they're saying if we're going to restrict guides, we need to restrict everyone. So the limited entry would be applied to all anglers. It's going to be a good, healthy discussion. So, okay.
Okay, the other initiative that we want to give you a brief update on was Skagit Steelhead Plan. It's been a topic of a number of comments from the public over, boy, the last year at least, I think. And I'll ask Annette Hoffman, our Region 4 Fish Program Manager, to update us on that.
So thank you. Yes, I've gotten a lot of input from our public on this, and I appreciate that a lot. Why aren't we right now able to offer any fishing opportunity in the Skagit? Because our ESA permit doesn't have a provision for that. So what are we doing about that? We're working with the co-managers to pursue a 4D take exemption of the ESA so that we could allow some directed fishing, whether it was catch and release or catch and harvest, on any harvestable surplus. So how do we get there? The past history, the current permit that we have has this 4.2% limit, which has pretty much allowed us and the tribes to have incidental harvest, whether it's through our sockeye fishery and we intercept steelhead kelts or something like that, or it's been any wild steelhead interceptions in our fishery that we had on the hatchery program. But it was limited to incidental fish only. So the good news is that the number of spawners in the Skagit River have seen an uptick. So so there is what a lot of people are seeing as harvestable surplus. Our current management strategy that we are have in place, which is before the ESA listing for the Skagit River, was we were looking for a floor of 6,000 spawners, and then above that there'd be an allowable harvest rate of 16%. So no directed harvest until you met that floor, and then you could have a some harvestable surplus there. We haven't been able to implement that plan since the ESA listing, but it's been identified in each of our annual management plans that we've put together. So obviously that increase in harvest or in spawners that people are seeing is generating a lot of excitement. Let me go into a little more detail about where we are in pursuing this 4D exemption. In order to do this, we have to submit a harvest management plan, a comprehensive one, to the federal government how we are intending to implement a harvest strategy, and they would take a look at that and see if that met their criteria for not impacting recovery of the listed fish. And we did submit a plan back in 2010 that had some analyses in there. It was Puget Sound wide, and they decided that our plan did not meet their comfort level. And so what this effort is trying to take the Skagit River out of the Puget Sound collective so that it will so the harvest there wouldn't be tied to what's happening in the Nooksack or the Green or the Dungeness or the Puyallup. So, and the good news there is that the Skagit River has more data and fairly good data, upon which to base this analysis. And we're doing this analysis. It's an abundance-based model that we're being used. We're updating the model with more recent data. We're developing this jointly with our tribal co-managers. We're not there yet, but we've made a lot of progress. We're not at square one. We're at square six or seven, and or ten would be our end game. So we've had several technical meetings with the tribes on these models, and we are working on developing some options. The model will be used not just to project spawners, but also what kind of harvest rate might we, you know, how does this 6,000 floor and 16% harvest rate, how is that going to protect fish? Can we be more aggressive? Do we have to be more conservative with the updated data? So we are targeting this fall or early winter to have a plan that we can submit to NOAA. We are wanting to bring the public along in this process too, in two ways. Before the submission to NOAA, once we have the model in place and we've got some results from it, we'd like to share that with the public so they can see what has gone into the plan and what that we're submitting to NOAA. And then after that, once we have a plan and there's a harvestable surplus that we could access, then there will probably be some stakeholder interest in how we access that. We have certainly heard input from a lot of interested catch and release and fly fishermen and also the catch and keep fishermen. So we are expecting to have those healthy discussions as well to further refine that plan for us.
Yes, Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you. Help me a little bit here on that. because I started working on this some time ago, and I talked to Bob Turner, and then I talked to Susan Bishop 8 or 10 months ago, and she said they're fine with it. It's now the co-managers got to sort it out. And so have we been having ongoing meetings? And I mean, I know most of the tribal folks there, and is there some resistance, some objection? I mean, I think this thing's gone on just about long enough to come to some conclusion, and I thought Noah was on board with the direction that we were going. What's happened here?
I do believe that's correct. Noah is on board. The meeting that we had with Noah, we talked about three different options of moving forward. The one option that they said we could implement today was we have some room in this 4.2% current cap. But that wasn't going to get us where we needed to go because it didn't have the directed fishing piece in there. Then the second one was they were talking about keeping the incidental only piece in there, but having maybe a more aggressive percentage, which again wasn't going to get us there. And then the last option was pursuing this 4D permit, which so she's right. Right now it's in our hands. We need to provide them this plan with this modeled input. It's taken some time because the plan that we put in before they didn't accept. So we had to try to figure out, well, we had to kind of go back to the drawing board. Well, you know, how can we do this differently? How can we give them a better analysis that they will have more comfort with?
And your confidence level is?
Pretty high.
Good. Thank you. Holzman.
Yes, Commissioner Holzman.
And being a hunter and living in the part of the world where I live, everything as far as elk are on permit, have you ever contemplated the idea of a weekend permit? So that way, because you open up a really good fishery like this, you're going to get deluged. And this way you could control the people and at least get these guys some fishing. That's what, I mean, they're wearing on me. I mean, when they're coming protesting this with their signs, I mean, my heart goes out to them. And it doesn't have to be an all or nothing deal. I mean, these guys would love, I'm sure, to be able to put in for a weekend permit to go fish, and that way you could control the situation. You wouldn't just have this mass hitting the river on a quote-unquote. Has anybody ever considered something like that?
That's a great suggestion, and I think that the phenomenon that Steve is experiencing on the coast with the increase in effort is likely going to happen on the Skagit River as well once we get a fishery in place. So that's a be a great thing to put on the table.
Well, and that way you could prove to the feds, you know, I mean, here's what's happening, and we are controlling it, and not just making it a wide open thing. So I think we need to look at this with some eyes from time to time.
On that topic, we've had some very good return to sockeye to the river, and the booster pool, we've had incredible numbers of recreational anglers and a huge spike in guide services that are providing just guide services. And we're seeing guide services from Idaho fishing the Brewster Pool. The guides go where the fish are. And Steve, I know what you're facing there, because as opportunity shrinks in other areas, they're going to, you know, they got to make their boat payment. So they're going to go where they can fill their boat. This is, and I mentioned the Upper Columbia because this is an issue that's not isolated to the peninsula or to the Skagit River if it opens. This whole idea of how to manage guide services is a statewide issue. As we see opportunities shrink, and also when we have a big spike in return of sockeye up the Columbia, what kind of impact that has on, say, the community in Brewster. I've tried to encourage the local guides in my area to form some kind of guides association so they can have some input to the state rather than the state put restrictions on them so that they're part of the process. But
I haven't had much success with that, but I know what you're dealing with, Steve, and it's going to be an issue as we see better opportunities. Particularly, I see that on the main stem Columbia and in the upper Columbia particularly, it's an issue we're going to have to deal with.
Mr. Carpenter?
Just one more comment on this. We don't have to worry too much about guides on the Skagit River because most of them are dead. But that's a true statement. The point I want to make is that the getting the Skagit River piece going, however you want to structure it, I think does a couple things. And the primary thing I think it's going to do initially or within a year or so, it's going to relieve a lot of pressure on the coastal steelhead streams. That is going to be very beneficial to those drainages. And I think that's because they're being overfished. And there's probably a lot of things going on there that need to be backed off a little bit. The other thing it's going to do, talking about rural communities, that upriver Cedar Woolley to Marble Mount area is a very much a rural community. And anything that can provide some economic improvement, I think is a great concern and something that we should be very cognizant of.
Mr. Mack?
One question. How do you know you have 16,000 fish coming back, and where are they going in the basin, just out of curiosity?
16,000?
How many fish are you saying are coming back?
Oh, I think the estimated, we haven't done the projections for this year, but the estimated spawner number, we haven't finalized it yet, but it's coming right in around the 9,000 mark.
How do you know that?
We do red surveys.
Throughout the basin?
We do aerial flights.
Even in the upper part of the basin?
We cover the upper part of the basin with a helicopter and helicopter flights.
Okay. Thank you.
And so, say, in this next year, you have a 3,000 fish over your 6,000 expected escapement, where I live, that means there's 3,000 fish available for harvest. Well, and if they're all wild, those aren't available for harvest. There's a mortality factor against that. Is there any hatchery returns on the Skagit at all?
We're not expecting any this year.
Okay.
This has been the returns that would have come this year were not released in the spring of 2014.
Okay. So this 4.2 would you consider that the mortality threshold?
The current permit limits the mortality on wild steelhead, all sources combined, to 4.2%.
So all four combined, so when you actually get to the point where you have the wild fish in the river and could consider a season if that was possible, that would be the accumulation of other incidental catches, and so you might have a very small percentage of available fish even in a catch-and-release fishery because of mortality threshold.
One of the things that the model is going to be taking a look at once we get it programmed is some different options for different harvest rates.
Okay.
Okay, we shall move on. And Mr. Carpenter nicely teed up this nice slide we've got here, and this is kind of flows from discussions with a number of commissioners, with Director Unsworth, a number of our stakeholders, and I think rightly during the last 5 or 6 years in Western Washington in particular, we focused on conservation because of a desperate plight of a lot of our populations. We're going to continue to focus on conservation, but looking forward, we want to put forward a vision of what steelhead fishing looks like in the future. And we want to be able to tell stakeholders across the spectrum, you know, what can they expect for the future? Because right now we have quite a polarized community out there. We've got wild steelhead advocates who at the farthest extreme suggest there should be no hatchery releases. We've got folks who like to catch and keep steelhead. We're worried there may be no opportunities for them in the future. So we want to focus on putting forward what I'll call this vision of steelhead fishing in the future, where we've got a mix of streams, where we've got hatchery production, probably rivers that aren't likely to contribute to recovery of wild steel in the future. We're going to have some that are strictly wild production. We know we've got some folks who catch and keep. We also know we got a lot of folks who like to catch and release steelhead. So our thought is we want to build a vision of what that future looks like for steelhead, particularly in western Washington, where I think we have the biggest challenge currently. Okay, I think this is the last policy area, monitoring and research. The finding of the steelhead science paper, we've touched on this a couple times through the presentation, that we need more attention for steelhead to monitoring diversity. And the policy statement basically directs us to implement the monitoring necessary, and here's a key phrase, to influence management decisions. So we're not just out there monitoring for monitoring's sake. We want it structured in a way that it can drive our adaptive management. The one that I want to highlight here, or two actually, first strategy is we recognize that we need some bigger scale studies to understand the relationship between climate change, environmental factors, the physiological status of steelhead, abundance, productivity, and diversity. And the probably the best example of where we've got that going now is with the Salish Sea Study. And you're going to have a fantastic presentation. If I ever stop talking, you're going to get that later today. The other one is the gene flow, assess the rate of gene flow between these segregated hatchery populations and the wild stocks. And we've got two young scientists in our fish program who have done an amazing job setting up these monitoring programs. So Thomas Buren's a PhD candidate at the UW, has set up our program for the Lower Columbia. Dr. Joe Anderson has set the program up for Puget Sound. And again, I know of nowhere else where a program of this scale and breadth and depth has been set up to monitor the effects of hatchery programs. So an amazing accomplishment. Initiated Lower Columbia 2014 and Puget Sound this year. Okay, so where are we at? In all fairness, I think we started from a pretty big hole. Five of our seven DPSs of steelhead were ESA listed. We put together a statewide steelhead management plan that's expansive, bold, and ambitious. And during the last 6 years, our implementation has focused by necessity, I think, on our priority conservation actions. And we talked through today just a few of those. We've reduced our hatchery risks. We've established wild steelhead gene banks. We've improved our monitoring programs. We've reviewed our fishing rules and provided additional protection for juvenile steelhead where that's necessary. And I didn't run this bullet by Jeff, but I'll speak it. I think Jeff and his predecessor, Lisa, have done a really amazing job re-energizing and refocusing our habitat program to get the protection and restoration that we need to be successful. So how have we done? Where I sit, I think we have implemented a new steelhead management paradigm. It's a fundamental change from where we were 10 years ago. We have a lot to do still. For steelhead, our Washington State fish.
Thank you, Jim. That was it. Yep. Any final questions for the briefing?
I just have one comment.
Mr. Carpenter?
I just want to thank the four of you at the table and your colleagues on this. I think this is a really high mountain to climb, but we got to get there, and I thank you for that, and I encourage you to stay the course.
Yes, well done. Everybody? Thank you.
Thank